Do you want me to start recording now, yeah? Oh,
Yeah,
it's
go ahead.
recording.
Start recording,
We're recording now.
yeah. Who's talking to me? Steph.
Steph.
Oh, good, darling. There you go. Hello, sweetheart. Yeah, start recording. And put the little, put the our first prayer up.
Yep. The refuge and bodhicitta, yeah?
Yeah, and also, I don't know if I mentioned, but it's auspicious. It's really auspicious that the center, this is the protocol, that we do the mandala offering first. I don't know, I forgot if we mentioned. There, see, that's there. Look, the mandala offering. But Steph, it's usually the center who offers that. Do you have an umze? Do you have a chant leader?
Well, I can chant it, Robina.
You do that. It's auspicious. So what's
Yep.
happened to Steph, on behalf of Land of Joy, they've invited, this event. And so they're offering a mandala. If we did it very formally, we'd have the representations of body, speech, and mind and the mandala. And at the time of the teaching, you'd go and offer those. It's got a great meaning. So this little prayer is based upon Buddha's cosmology, this ground. We just visualize this ground anointed with perfume. I'll just say it first. Then adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon. Well, we didn't know that our world consisted of that, did we? And we also, by the way, we didn't know, did we? We weren't taught at school that our sky is blue because it's reflecting off lapis lazuli. That's a brand new piece of information for you. So if you don't know Buddha's cosmology, don't worry. Just use ours and visualize all the marvelous things in the world, because that's all we're doing here, piling up with our mind, use our creative imagination, imagining all the marvelous things of the world that make people happy, and we pile them up and we offer to the Buddha as a request for the teachings. That's what we're doing here. Requesting, it's so auspicious. It's like you don't go empty-handed, do you? You don't go into the shop and ask for a meal and then not pay your bill. You don't go to your friend's house for dinner without offering something. It has meaning. So thinking this way, we're all offering. If you know the little mudra, you go ahead and do it, as Steph will sing it. But say that, think in your mind, offering, think in your mind, all these things, offering to the Buddha.
Thank you, Rabina.
Lovely, thank you, Steph. Good umze. So now we'll do this one. I'll lead this one. This is I say it every time. It's always good to hear it. What we're saying in this prayer, the first two lines are for those of us who already identify with being Buddhists, and so it's reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings and so forth. And the second is stating our purpose. Why are we here together? Although, as the lamas would say, stating our motivation for being here together. So as we're saying, I'll say it in English the first time, but I'll say the words differently. So we're saying, until I'm enlightened, we are going to rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then we're saying, and by all the virtuous karma that we create from listening to these teachings, may we become a Buddha to benefit all suffering sentient beings. So thinking like that. Sangye charang choke chognam la jang chu baru dagni kyab su chi dagi chönyen gi personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charang choke chognam la jang chu baru dagni kyab su chi dagi chönyen gi personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Okay, good. Okay. This book of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, it actually came out first, published by Wisdom, looking a bit like a Bible. It was a red, fat, kind of like a Bible, the sort of soft, hard covered and gold covered edges. And it was called How to Enjoy Death. And it was, but also there was a version in, anyway, that came out first. I mean, this is a completely revamped version, and it's a paperback, and it's now called How to Face Death Without Fear. So it started. This book started from Lama Zabo Rinpoche's teachings almost 20 years ago in Institut Vajrayogini in France, you know. Rinpoche was teaching on a completely different topic. And one of his old students, a dear friend of mine, she came and said, Rinpoche, my father died and I didn't know what to do. He just died and I didn't know what to do. So Rinpoche, I suppose, was quite surprised. I mean, she's a Buddhist for many years. But what I realize is we are all the same, you know. Because we're going to discuss this, because we have this incredible resistance to death, we don't want to know about death. We live in denial of death. Even if we're Buddhists, it's one of the topics that's up front. I mean, if we've studied the Lam Rim, we know, you know, Atisha start right at the beginning of the Lam Rim, Atisha gets us to think about death and impermanence. I mean, you can't escape it. And the whole of Buddhist view, all of Buddhist philosophy, all Buddhist view, you know, is couched. Are couched within this view of impermanence and change. And indeed, because of the Buddha's view of mind, beginningless and endless mind, there's constant change. So the idea of future rebirth, you know, past lives, future life, dying, is very much central in Buddhism. And it's based on this crucial philosophy that Buddha indeed, because he's not a creator, he hasn't made it up, that everything changes, like, you know, duh, you know. But I mean, he's pointing out the incredible mistakes we make because we're living in, we can't stand change. We can't stand the idea of our dying. So even if we're Buddhists, it's still deeply in there. We know all the words, but it hasn't touched our hearts. So this is the same as with my friend. You know, we're all the same. Her father died suddenly, and I didn't know what to do. So Rinpoche shifted gear completely and then proceeded to teach much of what's in this book. He also referred to a text. He says, Rinpoche says it, we mentioned it in the preface, in the introduction, whatever. I happen to edit it, by the way. That's why I'm familiar with it. So... there's one particular text by a Tibetan. I don't think it's been translated into English. This Tibetan in Dharamsala wrote this book, one book, and Rinpoche uses his commentary, for the basis of his commentary, about to remind Tibetans of all their traditions about death, you know. So Rinpoche often refers to that. He also refers many times to Song Rinpoche's teachings, his Lama, one of his teachers, and indeed his own, you know, and all his own past teachings himself. So it's basically, as Jenny mentioned, you know, one of the points that Rinpoche makes that if you want to help anybody in this life, if you want to help anybody, the time they need you most is the time of death. So straight away, that's quite shocking, isn't it? That's completely opposite to what we think. If we're philosophical materialists. Sorry, hang on. You know, if we're philosophical materialists, it's a very odd idea because the person is now at the end of their life. And this is actually indicated with great respect to all our culture. But I mean, this is often indicated by the behavior we have when people get old and sick and are dying. I mean, we even hasten their death so often these days, you know, because of all the, you know, the complications of systems and nursing homes and hospitals. And I mean, we hasten people's death because they're dead, they're old, you know, and you can even see, I'm looking at the negative side, you can see some of our really unhappy old people's homes. I mean, they're like horrible places where people are drugged out of their brains, television blasting all day, kind of waiting for them to die, you know. It's a terrible view. And this is a natural consequence, of course, of the view that once you're dead, there's nothing left. So the Buddhist one is fundamentally different. On the other hand, there's so much information in this book that is useful to people who aren't even Buddhists, Christians, so many people. It's useful for your animals. It's useful for people. I know many of the times I've used this book as a basis for, it came out first in 2016. And of course, all the teachings in it are from other sources that have been available in the FPMT for years, but not all integrated in one book. And I know when we were still visiting teach centers, I'd go around the world and Kopan, different places, teaching on this book. And people from, I remember in Australia, at least two courses, people from funeral home directors came. They're marvelous people because they're totally interested in death. And they're fascinated by what people think about death and how to, you know, treat respectfully different people with different views. It's also fascinating, I've seen these days too, it's really marvelous that even in the materialist world, many doctors and nurses now are electing to work in this area. It's something usually we just don't want to know about. But we know these days, you know, in the West, certainly in the West, there's so much talk about hospice, how to help people die well, you know, living wills, you know, all these kind of things. But of course, the radical point, the difference in the Buddhist one is that you're preparing for the next life. This is Rinpoche's main concern, you know, the whole point of why it's important, the time of death. We're going to go into these details. They're quite technical, quite precise. So, but I remember being very moved by a couple of conferences I went to in Australia, one in Sydney, was a marvellous doctor who was the head doctor in the hospital that dealt with sick and dying and dead babies, you know, children. And that's the most horrific thing for most people. We can't stand the thought of our children dying. I mean, if most of us don't have a view, if we're devoted Christians or Muslims, we have a view that God has a plan, these children belong to God. If you're really devoted, then it's a very peaceful experience for you. But if you're a materialist, and this is not being sarcastic, this is literal, the philosophical materialist view simply says, you know, you'll be nothing left. So there's no logic. We can't find an explanation for why children and children and babies die. It's so horrifying for us. So because of all this fear, there's so much stress and there's so much living in denial, and it's a very painful experience. I remember going to one conference by this doctor. It was very, very moving. People coming along and talking about and trying to open the whole topic up. And I remember he was a marvelous man, you know, and he had, I'll never forget the morgue in which the little dead babies were kept before they were buried. He had it decorated like a nursery. And the little children would, you know, it was open and you go in and out, and the little children would come and meet my dead brother, you know, making the topic so open. It was so moving, you know. So this is marvelous. This is incredible. All of this is incredible. But this extra component, which is the crux of it for the Buddhist approach, that we're at the time of death. And this is the point, at the time of death, as Rinpoche says, at the time of death, this, you know, according to there's two processes we need to learn. And they're both in this book. One is about the 12 links of dependent arising and a particular role of the 12 links at the time of death. And this is crucial to understand, and we'll go into it. And the other one is from the Tantric teachings, the Vajrayana. And this is very detailed, and anybody who's had any familiarity with the teachings will know about it. It's describing the death process in terms of eight stages. And it says eight stages of gradual deconstruction of the components of the person. And this is central in the highest yoga tantra practices. And there's a chapter in there, a marvelous chapter. Remember, you know, it's headed, I think it's chapter 10, I can't remember. But it's death is what the yogis have been waiting for. And we're going to discuss this as well. So there's a much broader perspective from the point of view of the Buddhists, in particular, of course, the Tibetan Buddhists, because you're not going to hear about the eight stages of death from the Zens, you know, because that's a different model. They don't have the Vajrayana. And as we know, the Vajrayana is the broader framework of all the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, since the beginning, since the 7th century when it first came with Guru Rinpoche. So this book is a handbook, basically, and there's masses and masses and masses of practical information. And so because there's so much information and so many practices, I mean, Rinpoche is renowned for finding practices and mantras and sutras that nobody else has ever heard of. And he's got this whole medicine cabinet of medicines, his entire kind of toolkit of tools. And so the way the book evolved, it was the only way to make it really workable, was to have all the practices in there as like at the end of the book. And in fact, it's 2/3 of the book. I mean, also the practices, because they're done at different stages in this process. So you can't keep repeating the practice when you read about it in all the instructions. All the practices are at the back and they're all numbered. And there's 87 of them, you know, from the smallest thing like particular mantra or to a particular word you'd say or a particular approach. They're all labeled as a practice. Makes them very easy to find. And of course, initially it's quite overwhelming. 87 practices, God heavens, you know. But no, as Rinpoche says, you choose whatever works for you, whatever you're familiar with, whatever level of practice you've got, whatever level of practice your loved one got, you know. And even if you do one practice at all, he says, medicine Buddha is the best. He repeats this constantly, you know. So the book is kind of the first part of the first, there's about six parts to it. The first parts are, you know, just practical information about the approach to death and why, and for example, why attachment is the main cause of why we have suffering at death. And then and one part is all about the section on the eight stages, a section on the 12 links of dependent arising. This is very practical. And then parts 4 and 5, I forget, you'll see in the book. And some of it in the course notes, you've got those PDFs. Quite a few of those have been excerpted in there. Then it's what to do the weeks and months before death. And this is, you know, and the whole point is the whole book is, of course, the teachings are to given to one. The person who's listening, it's information for us. But the whole book has to be referenced in terms of how to help your loved ones, you know. So it's all about how you help your loved ones die, but including your pets. There's so much information here. And this is something that people, non-Buddhists, love, because they adore their pets. Everybody wants to know, how can I help my pet? And the thought that you can do something to help the pet die well, and even afterwards, makes people very happy, you know. People feel hopeless otherwise. So it's for your grandma, your grandpa, your sister, the pets, the mouse in the kitchen, the ants. I tell you, it's to help the sentient beings die well because this is the point, and we're going to go into all this, is at the time of death, about before you stop breathing, technically speaking, that is when the karmic seed that that being has planted in their little bank vault of karmic seeds, this is my analogy, you know, and remember, we're going to discuss this, that every millisecond, according to the law of karma, which runs the universe, as far as Buddha's concerned, that all sentient beings in the entire universe, without exception, this is the natural law that runs the universe, the natural law such that every millisecond or whatever the ant or the mouse or the dog or the human thinks and does and says, programs that mind with those tendencies, drops seeds into their bank vault. There's nothing that goes astray. So it's at the time of death, in this gradual process of deconstruction, before you stop breathing, that's when the seed that will determine your next life is triggered. So it's a very powerful reason, not just some emotional reason to make everybody feel nice. Oh, grandma died so nicely. No, it's for grandma's sake that such, that because she's got billions of karmic seeds in her mind, negative and positive, and we want the positive ones to be triggered. And so this is the point, even more precisely, what enables the positive seed to be triggered is grandma being peaceful. Because when grandma's peaceful at the time of death, her mind is virtuous. And that has a natural relationship with the positive karmic seeds. If grandma's freaking out, and this is the point, you talk to people, you know, in the business. I remember a friend, this is it's not an uncommon occurrence for people to die with fear, because most people aren't prepared for it. Most people never thought of death. And if they're left alone in the hospital, dying, you know, drugged out of their brain on drugs, no family, no friends, no support, of course it's like a torturous experience. We've died millions of times, Buddha says. And so the memory of it is not there evident, but it's deeply in our bones instinctively. So there's so much fear involved because of attachment. And we'll discuss all this, you know. So death is usually horrible for most people, and therefore it triggers a negative karmic seed. Therefore, they go to the lower realms. And this is the whole point of Rinpoche's book, is to avoid that at all costs. Everything we can do. And Rinpoche, in fact, he says in the book, one of the chapters, he said, I can't stress enough the role that helpers play, you know. So let's look at that simple point. Look at this point alone, why it is we have so much fear. So this is, again, understanding Buddhist psychology. We've got to understand Buddhist psychology. And the reason there is so much fear, the two main delusions involved, the crucial one, the primordial one, is attachment. This primordial delusion, misconception, neurosis that runs the universe. All beings are driven by it. Until you're out of samsara, you're driven by this attachment, this constant craving to get what you want and not get the bad things. And it's just rooted in fear, because it's a direct result of the ego grasping, the root delusion. So because... The other one is because we have this, because we're so attached to me. As Rinpoche says, at the time of death, the greatest cause of the fear is attachment to me. And that means the body. Because let's face it, even if we're Christian and Muslim or Buddhist, and the Buddhists emphasize the mind and the Christians and the Muslims emphasize the soul, still this is what looms large, this bag of bones here. This is what we think is me. Totally, primordially, this is me. And we can't, and attachment cannot stand the thought of me not existing. It's just utterly primordial from countless lives of being programmed with this intense fear, you know, the attachment. So then because of this attachment, and I'm not sure even the way which one comes first, there's this other powerful delusion in the mind that is one of Buddha's first major teachings, all about impermanence, is, as Lama Zopa terms it, grasping at permanent me, grasping at permanent me. So because we can't stand, I mean, it's any attachment, because we can't stand the thought of the children leaving us or the husband dying or the handbag breaking or the cup breaking, because we are attached to having that thing, we want it to be set in stone. So then we impose this other lie upon it that it won't change. So our mind, as Buddha's saying this, our mind is riddled with misconceptions, is riddled deep in the bones of our being with lies that we've been practicing, believing in for countless lifetimes. The more, even just, you know, that even that should indicate to us the depth of these misconceptions in the mind, if they're eons old. They didn't just start when you were born, believe me, you know. So it takes a while to unpack them all. So because most of us aren't great yogis and yoginis who are able, you know, if you're, you know, one of the sections in the book, the later on, is once your loved one has died, there's a series of scenarios of what to do in the different scenarios, what to do if your loved one dies at home, what to do if your loved one dies in hospital, what to do if your loved one dies suddenly, what to do if your loved one gives their organs, what to do if your loved one is a yogi or a yogini, you know, as a practitioner. But in their case, you close the door and leave them in peace. They know what they're doing, baby. Just let them be. But most of us aren't like that. Most of us are ordinary beings. Even if we've got a Buddhist practice, we've still got so much fear and we haven't really done the thinking. I mean, we can see this in daily life. You talk to anybody who's been told they've got cancer, who's been told they're going to die in 6 months or whatever. You go through this intense process, you know, this unbelievable process, because attachment has been completely shocked. It's going to get what it doesn't want. It brings complete panic and aversion and fear naturally. And then we've got to go through this gradual process of acknowledging a reality that's always been there. It's like a big shock to us. What do you mean I'm dying? As if somehow you thought you weren't dying. So the problem of death, as Rinpoche says, death is normal. Death is nothing special. It's only because we have these lies deep in our mind about death that makes it so painful. So anybody who's a practitioner and who's been told they're going to die, that's the person who's really ready for death, because they're finally confronting the fact that's always been there. It's the same for any one of us. You know, there's no difference. There's no difference. We're all going to die and we don't know when. That's why Buddha's teaching in the Lam Rim, which our teacher teaches in Tsongkhapa, getting us to become familiar with this reality that we're impermanent and death is definite, the time of death is uncertain, and what to do at the time of death, what's important, you know. This should prepare us. So there's two ways of working with this whole process of death. One is how to live your life in the framework of understanding impermanence, and one is the actual process itself. The major points in this book are at the time, what to do the weeks and months before, the days before, the hours before, at the time the breath stops, the 3 days after the breath has stopped, and then when the mind leaves the body, and then the 49 days after that. It's a whole process. They're all the detailed instructions, which are incredibly important to learn. As Rinpoche says, it's education we all need, you know. But the other way, the crucial one, without which it's got to be quite tricky to die well, is to live your life in the framework of the fact of death. I mean, we can say impermanent. Muted. Okay, I'm now unmuted. Okay, all good. Okay, so let's look at how we, you know, the ideal way to live our life within the framework, based upon the reality of the impermanence of death. I mean, Buddhist teachings are extensive on impermanence, one of his first philosophical views, one of the first things you need to realize, and it's a stepping stone to realizing emptiness, actually. So he talks about gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. And subtle impermanence, you know, you need to have concentration in order to realize it in meditation. And people often can mistake it for emptiness. It's very interesting. But Atisha in his Lam Rim, which he wrote in the 10th, 11th century, whatever it was, and then is the basis for Tsongkhapa's commentary on the Lam Rim in the 14th century. The first step, the very entry level grade one junior school, the first thing that Atisha and then Tsongkhapa want us to think about is this reality of death. And his agenda there is because he wants us to get a wake up call, not to want to waste this precious life. It's the wake up call to get. And that's the point here. That's the point. So let's just look at the points that Atisha makes, that Tsongkhapa makes. And it's practical. So, you know, all of this, of course, is taught on the basis of Buddha's view that consciousness, our mind, is not physical. So let's look at remind ourselves what the mind is. So mind is not physical for the Buddha, fundamental. If Buddhism can be proved to be wrong, and there's no such thing as a non-physical mind or consciousness, then the whole of Buddhism will collapse into a heap of utter nonsense. So we're taking our hypothesis here, you know, we're hypothesizing that mind is not physical or consciousness, same. One. Number two, it's not the handiwork of a creator or mummy or daddy. Big surprise. Three, it's got far more subtle levels, and this is absolutely crucial to understand the death process, especially these eight stages. Three or four, whatever the numbers were. It doesn't begin at birth. If you're not the handiwork of mummy or daddy or creator, and the view there is that you began in the mother's womb, isn't it? The Christians, I think, say that soul, that conception is when God puts a soul there. I think the Jews, I learned recently, is that God puts a soul there a few months later, which is why for them at a certain point to have an abortion isn't killing a human being, because the soul isn't there yet. So there's different views. That the Buddha's view pretty much is that the time of conception, when the egg and sperm come together, that's when the consciousness from before comes into it. So consciousness didn't begin at conception, or even, you know, comes from before. And when it will continue after death. This is a fundamental point that's assumed in this entire book, assumed in the Buddhist teachings. Your consciousness comes from before, programmed with your karmic imprints, your past habits. Your mummy doesn't give you anger and jealousy and love. Mummy doesn't give you being good at football or music. You bring it with you from before. This is a fundamental point in Buddhism. And that everything you think and do and say throughout this life programs your mind, so seeds in your mind. And then at the time of death, whatever seed is most, you know, is most prevalent. It's a very sophisticated thing that happens. No one runs it. So whichever seed is the one that is most, it's the strongest one that's, and then it's what, and the way you do die is the one that triggers whatever that seed is, which is already programming, even before you stop breathing, already, even before we stop breathing in the past life, okay, whatever life we could have had, we could have been a kangaroo, and not more than a few weeks before we found our way to our mummy's, you know, fallopian tube where it joined the egg and sperm. Already we were dying, and before we even stopped breathing, the karmic seed that determined, that already programmed us to go to this present mother's human womb. So we create the cause to go to mummy and daddy. They don't make us, they're just here having fun. We come barging in, you know. It's a crucial point in Buddhism, this. So, right, that the mind continues is the whole point, and all the teachings on the basis of this, to ensure that death is a good experience, that it's virtuous, but even better than that, not just by helping others, because you can't ask a mouse to live a good life, you can't necessarily ask your grandma to live a good life, she's already dying, so then you do everything you can to find the conditions to be appropriate and conducive for grandma to be peaceful, therefore for grandma to be virtuous, so that her mind will continue in another decent human life so she can carry on bopping on her spiritual path. That's the bottom line. So impermanence then, the gross impermanence is what a teacher gets us to think about, not forget about subtle impermanence. Gross impermanence. Subtle impermanence is the fact that the very coming into being of something necessarily implies it's going out of being. And it's it really is an excellent meditation to do that can lead you to realizing emptiness. It's very powerful. But here, Atisha's not concerned with that. He wants us to get us right behind the eyeballs, you know, and get us to think about how impermanence in relation to death. Whose death? My death. And this is the major point. We know about death, you know. So the very first of these three points, and there's got subdivisions in those, are just bullet points to think about, to contemplate, to become familiar with. The first one is that death is definite. So we'll go, yeah, all right, we know that. Give me something more intelligent, please. We couldn't care, because that sounds so boring. We all know that. But yeah, Buddha says you know it, but you don't know it. We know it intellectually, but there's an immense disconnect. There's an immense gap between experiential, the reality of it, and the intellectual. We've got to make it experiential. And the point is why. The third of these three is the point, is the action point. That implies the action point. There's always an action point, okay? So the first one, you know, what we know that you can do this in formal meditation, like you can just do the analysis, do the thinking through, and you've got concentration in your meditation, and you go through these points, and it goes in more deep because you're being quiet. But we must do it every single second of the day. So what is the essential point? That everything that comes into being, every sentient being, every ant, every human, even a creature that even lives for 3 seconds, a being who lives for 90 years, either way, you know, that being, by the very existence, the very fact of coming into a being, will die. Fact. This is scientific fact. This is not religion. But we just can't stand it, so we don't want to hear about it. We don't want to think about it. But the thing is, we do see it, and these days we're so bombarded, aren't we, by the world. It's so shocking now, you know. We're just bombarded daily through every imaginable type of source. We're hearing about death constantly. And not just if we didn't even read our iPads, we'd look around, you know, ants. I mean, I've got ants living with me. You know, they're going to be dying all the time. They get too close to the stove, or you don't realize it's there, and you stand on it, and you see this poor little thing dying an agonizing death. Beings die. So the thing is, what we don't get, this is the point, we don't get the learning from it. We go, oh, you know, if it's a mouse, we feel a bit sorry, but we're kind of relieved that the damn mouse is now out of the way, you know. If it's the ants, you're sort of a bit sorry, but, you know, they're such a hassle to get into your dinner and everything, you kind of wish they'd go away. It's hard to have compassion. So mostly it's just annoyance, and if they do die, you feel a bit sorry, but that's the end of it. If it's your, you know, your beloved, if all the people out there in the war zones, you read about it all the time and get very distressed. So we have all these different responses to it. We get angry, we get upset, we have compassion. All of this, it's okay. But we're not getting the point. The learning is, you know that lovely text, lovely, hardly lovely, scary, that text by Pabongka Rinpoche that usually is translated as heart spoon. It's all about impermanence and death. And the end, the verses end, he's very brutal, Pabonka. And the end of every verse, it says, this will happen to me. This will happen to me. Something like that. That's the conclusion. Every time you see an ant die, this is how you get the learning. This is how, what the action point is. This is when the wake up call happens. You don't just see, oh yeah, the ant's dead. Oh yeah, all these people dead. Look at them, you know. No, that'll happen to me. That's when the wake-up call will come. You stop in your tracks and you're making it real for you. That's the whole point of this approach. Death is definite. Now, the thing is, it's very distant from us most of the time. It could be a bit closer. It's our family or our country. I always tell this story. I was reading my iPad of the New York Times and I saw a heading down on the right-hand side on the homepage, 350 people die in a ferry accident in Tasmania. Well, I'm Australian. I mean, I'm a Brit as well. I've got a passport. And, you know, my daddy was English and I feel like I'm a POM. But I'm still Australian. So I saw this and I went, oh, no, because Tasmanians are my people, aren't they? And then I looked closer and it said Tanzania. Oh, so okay, I said, it's okay. Because it's not my people. Of course, I caught myself. I read it. I tried to have compassion. This is natural. When people distant die, it doesn't really touch us. Now it gets a bit closer and it's your country, your people, your neighborhood. And we're shocked. You read anybody who's had a murder in their neighborhood. They interview the people. Oh, this is so shocking in our neighborhood. I mean, people are dying in other countries never endingly, but we couldn't care less because it's not our neighborhood. Check us. Then we get a bit more shocked. We still don't make the point. We still don't get the point. Even closer, now when your beloved dies, when your baby dies, when your pet dies, when your husband dies, it is beyond shattering. But we still don't get the learning. We need to say, okay, get over your grief of your husband dying. I'm not being sarcastic. Get over the grief of your beloved baby dying. I mean, yes, you must. But remember, the point that's got to arise immediately is that this is going to happen to me. This is the one we never think. And this is the one that's the point. This is the one that brings the wake-up call. And this is the one that that ends up transforming our mind and completely changing the way we live our lives. Why? Because we're gripped by attachment. We're gripped by the idea that everything's permanent and forever. Like I always quote, you know, poor Nicole Kidman. I'm not bad-mouthing her. When I read an interview years ago when she was with Tom Cruise still, we will be together until we're 80, she said. That's how we feel. Because this is the point about attachment. When the thing that you've got now, we're talking about our own life, but forget that, your relationship, for example, when it's going beautifully, look at what we do. We take it for granted. When you go to work and you've got Tom back home and the kids and you can't wait, you're thinking of them, you're visualizing them, they're all going to be there. With absolute certainty, you know that when you get home, they will be there in the house. And that's grasping at things as permanent. This is what we do all the time. It's a primordial misconception. So we live in La La Land. We live in a fantasy. We live in a bubble of nonsense, you know. We will be together until we're 80. So that's how we feel about ourselves. That's what it means, how we feel permanent. Now, we know, we look in the mirror every day. We know we're not permanent. But we still can't believe it. I'm telling you, even when I edited this book, it really helped me begin to get some understanding about the fact that I'm going to die. I'm not joking. I've been a Buddhist for how many years, blasting these words out of my mouth, still in your bones. This is the second point now, the time of death is uncertain. I know with certainty I will not die today. I can tell you that. In my bones I feel that. And we know this. We all feel the same. So I love this story. I love this story about this astrologer, Tibetan astrologer. He did his own chart. And it said in his chart, the calculations indicated that he would die today. So if he's an astrologer, it means he's a yogi. He's a holy being, you know. He could even have been a monk or whatever, but a holy being, because these astrologers are pretty amazing. So there he is. The first thing he did was, oh, where did I make a mistake in my calculations? Because he couldn't believe he's going to die today. So in fact, he died today. This hilarious story, they all tell it differently. And it must have been a friend with him who saw it. While he's sitting there poking his ear, trying to work out where his calculations are wrong, some pointy thing, and his arm got hit and it goes in and he dies. He died right there. He couldn't believe that he was going to die today. Look at your own mind. We're all the same. It's really kind of hilarious. This is showing the extent of the grasping at a me that is not changing. Why? Because we have unbelievable attachment to me, and attachment cannot stand the thought of not me. So these are deeply ingrained and they're layers and layers and they all relate to each other, you know. They just deepen the bones of our beings. So this very first one to contemplate every day will loosen the grip of that grasping, will loosen the grip of attachment. And then all the lamas say that even just getting a reasonable realization of impermanence, your whole life is transformed. Because suddenly you realize that if you could die today, suddenly all the dramas have less power. What's the point of being angry with next door neighbor when you could die today? What's the point of getting angry with your husband when you could die today? What's the point of being, you know, being attached to your house if it could burn down today? You don't become cynical. You don't become kind of like indifferent. And that's what we tend to think. In other words, if Tom could leave me today, you think, what's the point of bothering? No, that's nihilism. Given that everything is impermanent, within that you then make it worthwhile. And so it's such a good example in our own lives. You know, we know it. When you go away for a holiday, even for a weekend, some nice resort and a gorgeous 5-star hotel or whatever, let's say, and you're really looking forward to it, and it's so delicious. You get there and it's delicious, and the meals are delicious, and the beach is just outside, and this is the point now. This is the point. You know you have got precisely 2 days. So this is the point. You know it's impermanent. You know it's impermanent. You know it'll end at any second. So because it is impermanent, because it's only 2 days, you don't just go, you don't say, well, why bother going on a holiday? It's only 2 days. It's not forever. I mean, what a joke. But this is the point. Because it's only 2 days, you make the most of it. Even if you've got a headache, you won't just lie in bed and go, oh, I'll go swimming tomorrow. There's no tomorrow. You'll have to go back home again. So because it's impermanent, you make the most of it. That's the attitude of seeing life as impermanent. Because it's impermanent, because you could die today, you don't want to waste a single second of it. That's the point. That's the point. That's the point. So the third point, this is where you get the action. Finally, just looking at the basis of this, of not wasting it, what's that mean for Buddha? Well, one, given that your consciousness goes back and back and back, given that it will continue after you die. Two, given that every millisecond of what you think and do a day programs your mind and leaves seeds in your mind, such that at the time of death, the negative or the positive ones, depending on the way you die, which we're going to talk about, will be the one that determines your next life. And given that, hey, honey, you don't want suffering, you do want happiness, well, it follows logically. The action point at the third point is to work out what is it that at the time of death, this is such a practical issue, you know. Don't hear it as emotional, fearful, religious. At the time of death, if this is true, the givens I just said, then it follows logically your body is no use to you, your beloveds are no use to you, your house is no use to you, your possessions, your job, your reputation. This is logical. We all know you can't take it with you. We say it like a joke. But this is putting meat on the bones of it. If that's true, then the only thing that's of any use to you is your mind. And in your mind, what's of use to you? Not your negative ones. That's a certainty. You don't want to bring negative ones with you. That's garbage. So the only thing at the time of death, logically, practically, based upon this view of the Buddha's, that is any use to you is your virtuous karmic seeds in your mind. That's it. So if that's true, you better start accumulating them right now. That's the attitude. That's the view. This becomes the basis of living your life. You can't practice without this. Without this, there's no foundation. Watching your mind every day, being holy, what for? You don't know why. This is the reason why, the most basic reason. That's it. It transforms your whole life. Everything, you lead your life in the framework of the reality of impermanence, which is reality anyway. Just that we're blind to it. So by seeing the truth of it transforms the way you see your life. It makes practice so much easier. It gives you a logical reason for practice, you know. Without this, you can't live a life properly. Without this view, there's no real impetus to want to be a better person. I mean, unless you're very, very holy. You've got to logically realize that the only thing you want in your mind is virtuous seeds, because they're the ones you want to ripen at the time of death, because they're the ones that will give you another decent human rebirth so you can keep on moving on your spiritual path. So don't keep putting, in other words, you don't want all those weeds in your garden. You want the flowers, darling. That's it. That's the view. So think about this every day. And like everything, something that's new to us, you have to learn it. You have to squeeze your brain to remember it. But like anything, if you practice it every day, it becomes automatic. And then eventually what a realization of impermanence is, it just becomes implicit for you. It's just there. It's just, you know it. But you've got to think it first. Intellectual is always the first step, stepping stone to the experiential. That's the main one, starting with that. Okay. Okay. So remember in the book, the first part, as I said, it's the first part when it's coming to the understanding how to help the person. Like I said, it's framed in terms of how to help your loved one. So the very first part is like getting the conducive for a person who's going to, you know, who's got weeks and months to live, months and weeks, who's dying slowly. This is the book is sort of for them. Obviously, there's there too to know what to do for the ones who die immediately, die quickly. But the whole idea, the ideal scenario, and the interesting point is for Buddhists, the best way to die is to know that you're dying. That is so shocking to us, we can't believe it. This is the best. You should be so lucky, and I'm not being sarcastic here. I'm not being sarcastic, I'm not being cynical. But to be prepared. You know, we are all dying, but some of us happen to know that we've got a disease. And then we usually feel sorry for those people. It should be the exact opposite, you know. The exact opposite. Because that person has got the wake-up call. You realize you're dying. But even then it's hard. I mean, I've got my friends on death row. When you think of all people who think that they've really got death is definite are the ones on death row. But, you know, if they're caught up in their own misery like everybody else, they feel like permanent like everybody else. Or even if you are going to die, you know, you've got death row. One of my friends, Frank, in Kentucky on death row, he was preparing for all his appeals and all that, you know, having to continue to live. And he's also then eventually preparing for his death by execution. But then he got leukemia. And leukemia got him instead. He died in a month. He wasn't ready for that. He'd even made permanent his death row, his execution date. But he died before. He got leukemia instead. So even that's impermanent, you know. You can't even guarantee you're going to die on schedule. You choke on the piece of your last meal before they execute you. So, what's a conducive environment? This is a really crucial piece. Rumi goes into this in different points in one of the chapters, the very beginning. Because you want your loved one to be peaceful. Don't just say that like, oh, it's so nice. She's so peaceful. There's a meaning to it. There's a logic to it. When the mind is peaceful, and check yourself in your daily life, when your mind is relatively peaceful, you know why? Because anger and attachment and anxiety and depression and jealousy and all the others are a little bit more quiet. So then your mind has the space for love and compassion and kindness to be there, and that naturally means your mind is peaceful. There's this natural, logical relationship between virtue and peace. Check your own experience. This is logical experience. You know, this is not some religious idea. Check one day when you wake up and you're fairly peaceful. It's because you're not too anxious. It's because you're not too angry, too attached, too jealous. The second delusions come, they grip your mind. And then that's when the nightmare is there. And that's exactly what we have to try and enable our loved ones to not be like. So what is your role then as a helper? So first of all, this job that's implied in Rinpoche's book, The Helper, in this scenario of helping your loved ones die peacefully, it implies that you're in charge. But if you're only the fifth cousin and you don't have any power, what can you do? You can't do most of this advice because you're not the person who calls the shots. So obviously, the person in the book that's being referred to is the person who calls the shots, who's in charge of your grandma's death, who can control who comes into the room and what goes on. And that might not always be the case, but if it is, then marvelous. I mean, if it's not the case, at least you can try to give advice to the people who are in charge, but often you can do nothing. So this implies that you're in charge of the process. So the crucial thing is to have the room beautiful. This is a very surprising thing. When you think of a sick room, it's usually horrible, dark and dingy. And we think it doesn't matter. We think, oh, she's sick and she's old and she's in a coma or she's senile. It doesn't matter. It matters. We have the five senses, you know, and our five senses are very susceptible. So if you, you know, like, and this is why, in a way, with all due respect to dear, kind doctors and nurses, hospitals, unless you're rich and have got your own private room, they're not the best way to die. They're full of noise and banging and clanging and machines and other people and tears and crying and doors banging. It's the worst way to die. And especially when you get closer to death, and this is everybody's experience, especially the Buddhist approach too, as you're getting closer to death, your mind, your grosser level of mind, your sensory consciousness and your gross conceptuality gets less powerful, and you're getting closer to your subtle consciousness, and then you're incredibly sensitive to the tiniest noise, the tiniest distraction, you know, especially as you're getting closer to death. It's unbelievably important to have total quiet. And as Rinpoche says, the only thing that matters is the sound of mantra, the sound of prayers or whatever it is, you know, because the mind is so susceptible. So in general, have the room beautiful. It's ideal to have a beautiful scenario, to have big windows, have a lovely sky, things growing, pleasant things, the sky. I mean, one of our friends, Tricia, a nun who's born in the same year as me, so it's like a wake-up call for me. We're both born in the year of the monkey, 1944. And she ran our center in India, in Bodh Gaya, Root Institute. She's in India. She's been in India for like 50, 60 years, most of her life, actually. She ran the Root Institute. And, you know, she was fit and healthy and vibrant. And she went back to Australia to see some friends. She was English. And she got sick and she went to the hospital. They said, you're going to be dead in 2 months. You've got some virulent cancer. So she checked with Rinpoche, Lama Zopa, and there's nothing to do. You're just going to die. You're going to die. You might as well stay in Australia, die there, find a good place. So she went to Chen Raising Institute, which is in Queensland, the north in Australia, the tropics. And there's no real place where she could stay there. So next door, there's this gorgeous place. It looks like Bali. They've got a beautiful view in the distance of the hills. And it's about 20 miles to the beach. You've got these lovely images and Buddha statues. It's the most gorgeous place, the most beautiful environment. So she chose to stay there, had this room with beautiful vistas. Because why? You want your mind to be spacious. You know yourself, if you're in a cluttered room with noisy things, and you go all in, you know, dark and dingy, and you're already depressed because you're sick and old. So have space, and everything in that room, this is crucial, everything in that room should be conducive for the person who's dying to leave good imprints in their mind. So if they're Buddhists, for example, like Tricia, whatever, what happened, have statues, have her guru's picture, have the only sound should be mantra or teachings, the thing she sees, because we've got senses, they're the doorway to our mind. So everything, and because of the other point, is a crucial point in Buddhism. Every tiny thing we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, nothing goes astray. Geshe Tashi, you know, when he was in London, Geshe Tashi said, it's like you're shooting a movie all day. It's just the way the mind works. Everything we've ever seen and experienced since beginning of this time is imprinted as a memory in our mind, which is why eventually we're going to have clairvoyance. So everything in that room was going to leave an impression, and it's dark and dingy and noisy. There's no space for that person's mind. But if they're sick and old, you're waking up out of a sleep, you know, and you have this lovely views and sweet things. It's just this powerful imprint in your mind. It's the same for your pussycat and your dog, please. I had a friend in Australia, had all these guinea pigs. So, you know, her guinea pigs, one of them has died. So she has medicine Buddha mantras in the little house for the guinea pig. She's got pictures of medicine Buddha on the ceiling of the guinea pig house. So everything the guinea pig sees and hears is the Buddha's. This is so powerful. And the logic of it is because everything leaves an impression in the mind. And everything we see in this life is because we've seen it before. How come you're attracted to tennis? It's because you've got a connection with it. How come you're attracted to the Buddha? Not because we're so intelligent and we realize Buddha's so good. It's because we've done it before. The impressions in the mind is the familiarity there. So this is hugely important. The room should be beautiful, spacious, peaceful, clear. This is really special. Now, the next point is, if you're the boss of this process and for your grandma or your beloved, you really have to control who comes into that room. You don't be like a policeman, but you don't, you know, for example, you keep out the pets. Now, this is the shocking, especially for you Brits who adore, but I mean, the whole world is the same. I see some of these animal shows now and people kiss their dogs on the mouth. They have them in their bed with them. This man says, I'm in love with my dog. She puts her legs around me. I think you'd be embarrassed to admit that. But that's how people are with their pets. It's so horrible. We think it's love. So that's the trouble. That's our big major point. We can't distinguish between love and attachment. This is the most shocking part of our culture. We cannot distinguish between love and attachment. So because the one thing you do not want on your grandma's mind, as she's dying, the process of dying and death itself, you do not want attachment to be triggered. And this is the powerful point, that what triggers attachment, the attachment's in the mind, and it's this emotional hunger for something. So it's through the senses, it needs something to glom onto. So if you've got the television all day, all of grandma's mind will just grasp onto the television. If it's her pet there, she'll hunger after that pet, stroke it and love it. You're putting the most incredible imprints of attachment in your grandma's mind. Don't be surprised, it'll trigger a course to become a dog herself. So you want everything in that room to not trigger attachment, to not trigger anger. So she's got some mean grandchildren who hate her. You keep them out of the room. Everything should be done for the benefit of your grandma. Everything in that room, every person who walks in, every sound, everything you see should be conducive for the peace of mind of your grandma. You've got to know this. As Rinpoche says, this is education we all need to have, you know. The doctors and nurses, their job is the body. Our job is the mind. This is so important, you know. I mean, this is the thing, there's all those people in the old people homes, you know, they just have them television blasting all day and they're drugged out of their brains. That's another whole discussion, which we'll talk about the drugs and things. So there's attachment is frantic to cling to something. It's you know, the grossest level of our attachment is for sensory objects. So you keep putting the television there. Even your grandma can't do anything with her mind. It'll just go to the junk on that television and she'll hold on like a vampire to that. People talk about that at the time of death. People can't let go. That means attachment. So you stop giving them things to grasp at. And if there is something there, make it holy. Make it the Buddha. If they're a Christian, put Jesus there. If they love Our Lady, put Mary there. If they love the saints, put the saints there. Then all their mind can go to that. That can bless their mind. It's really, you need to understand these things. You know, and this is Rinpoche's book is so helpful. I remember one lady I went to see in California years ago, had cancer, lived on her own, had friends coming to help her, sort of not really Buddhist, but knew a bit about Buddhism. She liked Lama Yeshe. And I could see, I mean, I never sat with people who were dying, very rarely, you know. And I was with her for a while and I thought, what am I going to do to help her? I hadn't studied much of this. Because you could see she was so stressed, mentally really distressed, you know. Tossing and turning and anxious, and because the mind, nobody knows what to do with their mind, because finally the thing that is called death that you'd never thought about is now coming and you can't avoid it any longer, and you don't know what to do, you don't know what to think about, you don't know how to navigate all this. This is what most people are like. So I just sat with her and I thought, well, I'll just say a mantra. So I just sang quietly a mantra, you know. I've found this many times, you know. She just immediately became quiet, and this is the point. Because when the mind has got nothing to hold on to, because we've got attachment and we don't know what to do with it, if there's nothing to hold on to, then you're sort of desperately clinging to something. But as soon as something happens, like a sound, and I sang a mantra quietly, everything in her mind just went to that. And so because it was pure and because it was Dharma, her mind became peaceful. It was so logical, you know. I remember one old crazy old lady I went to see in some old people's home was out of her brain, you know, paranoid. And the same thing, I just sang a mantra. Instantly she became quiet. Instantly her mind calmed down. When you understand the logic of this, when you understand attachment, you know how to help people. It focuses their mind and it calms their mind, you know. And because it's holy, it leaves a deep imprint of the Buddha's, which is what you want. Same with the mouse, same with your doggy. Don't just bring your doggy off to the poor vet. Vets spend most of their time killing these days. Let it die peacefully. Let it hear the sound of mantras, the most precious gift you can give, you know. Make your little doggy's place conducive. The bird you find on the road, put it in a safe place because it's so scared. Put it in a safe place, quiet. Let it hear the sound of a mantra and it'll become peaceful. We're so convinced that it's the physical suffering that causes the anguish. We can't tell the difference. And this is a profound point to think about. Whether it's the mouse or your grandma, when we see a person distressed, we think it's the physical pain. You can medicate that, but you cannot medicate mental pain, because when you go into the drug-induced stupor, your mind is still distressed. You can't stop that. Your subtle mind is there and you'll have these nightmarish dreams. You can't make the mind peaceful by giving drugs. It's the opposite, you know. Mouse the same, dog the same. And that's the thing we don't understand with respect to us in the materialist medical profession. Oh, she looks so peaceful, we'll say. But she's tossing and turning. Her mind is so distressed. And then she'll wake up out of her coma and tell you her terrible dreams, you know. And you know yourself, you can look very peaceful. You can be asleep in bed and you wake up in the morning and you tell your hubby you had this nightmare, but he wouldn't have known. You look very peaceful, but your mind was like in terrible distress. And this is the whole point too. The medical profession, with respect, doesn't understand the subtle mind. The subtle mind is what dreams. The subtle mind is what occurs in the coma. This is Buddha's expertise with respect, especially the Vajrayana. So you make the room conducive to peace. And when the mind is peaceful, the mind can be virtuous. The mind can be receptive to hearing mantra, to having conversations. One of the chapters is, the next chapter would be, you know, what to talk about. There's what to think about, what to see, what to touch, what to meditate on. There's all these endless different practices, Rinpoche's recommendations, you know, according to the needs of the person. As he says, you've got to know the mind of the person. You don't, you know, talk about green Tara to a person who likes Our Lady. She'll have a mental breakdown. You have to know the person's mind, what's best for them, you know. So make the room really beautiful, quiet, peaceful, calm. Have people come in who you know it's good for grandma's mind. For example, there's one of the grandchildren that she's totally attached to. That's as bad for her as bringing in the one who can't stand her, because it triggers her attachment. It's not trying to be like a policeman. You've got to understand attachment, understand the delusions. And in the world, we don't understand it. Buddha's got a very specific view about attachment. When we understand that, we'll really know how to help the loved one. So then all the practices, what to do, you know. How are we going? 9 o'clock. So, okay, about time for some questions so far, okay? We'll just sort of, about time, it's time for questions.
Okay, if anybody would like to ask.
About what I've discussed so far, not anything else that I haven't discussed, because it's all going to come. You'll get all the answers, I promise. But what I've discussed so far only, if there's things you'd like to clarify.
So if you want to just raise your blue hand, if you have a question for Robina.
Or just turn off your mute and shout at me.
Yeah.
Anybody? Nobody. Okay, I'll keep going then.
So, sorry, can I quickly?
Yes, Kelly.
Yes, go ahead, Kelly.
Just saying about not having people in the room who the person has a strong attachment to. So having spouses in the room for some people then could actually be a negative thing. Could
okay, be the thing key point, Kelly, I didn't make it. Yeah, sorry. The key point is, if the person, let's say it's your grandma, and let's say she's totally attached to you, but let's say you're really understanding of how to work with that, and you can try, you, in other words, if you come in with your attachment, you're weeping and grasping at grandma, and she's weeping and grasping at you, that's a disaster. But if you know what you're doing, and she loves you, you are the best person to be there, because you know how to navigate it. You know how to help her. You know how to transform the attachment into something that calms her. So you've got to be conscious and aware. If the person, if it's like the pet comes in, and she's totally attached to the pet, or a little grandchild weeping and crying, that's about, you know, you keep all emotions. Yet everybody in, one of the key points is everybody in that room should be conscious that everything that you say and do is only for the benefit of your grandma. Everything that goes on in that room is for your grandma's sake, not for our sake. And this is a trouble too, Kelly, which is we're so overwhelmed by our own grief and our own loss and our own suffering. We get confused and think this is all about us. But this whole book is about how to help the loved one. One person, when they read this manuscript, I asked her to check it for me. And she said, where's the chapter on grief? I said, that's not the point here. That's all about us. That's something else. This is for the dying person's sake. And that's a brand new idea for us. We're not how we think in the West. We're very convinced. We're very concerned about how we feel once grandma's dead. Now we can deal with our stuff. But that's not the issue in this book. So everything in that room, what's there, what you see, what you hear, what you touch, who's in there, and everything should be for the grandma's sake. You get the point? Good point, Kelly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What else? Kimberly.
Morning, Venerable.
Hello, happy to see you. Yes, darling. Yeah,
I know. It's been wonderful. So I'll be
bright, isn't it?
Zoom talking to you a little bit with your teachings.
What, darling, what do you say?
Oh, my dad, he's just been shipped to the old folks' home. And it's a good thing, positive situation. But he's got dementia. Mm-hmm. And he's always loved Winston Churchill war videos.
Oh, really? I love it.
Yeah. So I know he's going to be on a Winston Churchill World War II loop.
Okay, I understand.
And as far as I know, my dad, he was once in seminary, maybe in his 20s. He got kicked out. Which is another story. But anyway, way back, he obviously was a believer in Christianity.
Okay, so who's the point is that, Kimberly, the key question here then, who is in charge of what goes on in your father's room? Who's in charge?
My stepmom, and she was a palliative care nurse for 30 years.
Okay. So okay. Do you have a good, is she Christian herself?
No, absolutely kind of materialistic-y.
So do you have no contact with your daddy?
Well, it's COVID-19, but those things will probably change, and hopefully he won't die till it's over, but I don't know.
Do you have phone calls with him?
Yep.
Well, then you can talk about God to him. This is where you can help, Kimberly. This is the point. You can't ask your stepmother to do it. You might be able to, but you are the one. When you talk to your daddy, you can just say, you know, I've been thinking about God lately, Daddy, and God loves us all. This is one of the chapters, if you get Rinchey's book, What to Talk About. So you've got your, there's a perfect example. You know, you can just be casually talking on the phone to your father. Remind him of God. Don't tell him, think about God, Daddy. But I've been thinking about God lately, and God is in heaven, and God loves all of us. And I'm really looking, actually, Daddy, I'm looking forward to going to heaven. I don't know when I'm going to die. But then start thinking the concept of God for him. Think about God. God loves you. Even sing a little prayer in his ear.
Okay.
That's the kind of thing, and it leaves an imprint, and it might get his little mind going. It'll bring up the concept of God. His mind will become more spacious, and the holy beings can come in and bless him, you know? Or you can even have a close relationship with your mother, with his wife.
What's that?
You have a close relationship with his wife. No, obviously not.
No, I guess. There's surface love, but the depth of connection isn't there.
So you couldn't suggest things like have some prayers for him to listen to. Would she like that idea? To make him...
I don't know that she would.
This is where you can help by having phone calls with him. At least that. And you can maybe sing a few mantras. You know, like Om Mani Padme Hum. He doesn't know it's Buddhist. It's just a lovely sound. It'll leave an imprint in his mind going. Even you just sing it for a few minutes. Om Mani Padme Hum. You sing it. Leave an imprint in his mind right there. And tell him God loves him. Tell him heaven is beautiful. Just set the little thing in motion.
He's a sharp one, this one. I might get some pushback from my dad, but...
You can talk to him, have a discussion about God. Make it like a conversation between two intelligent people.
Yeah. He tells me God has to be found within. That's what he told me once.
Good thing. We'll talk about that. Exactly. Talk about that, darling. In other words, don't just waste your life on the talking about what he feels like. Bring up these conversations. This is the most precious way you can help your daddy's mind. You see my point? If he says those words already, he's got a feeling for it. He's wonderful. So you just have these conversations, and this will be so delicious for his mind. Nobody else will have them with him. I talk about his body all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is how you can help him, sweetheart. Have conversation with him. Respectful conversations, you know, and you can talk about how you are thinking about it yourself and ask him questions. And the very fact of him thinking about it, talking about it, they're leaving the best imprints in his mind, sweetheart. So beneficial.
Wonderful. Okay. And the Churchill videos, we just have to leave those.
Relax, let him have what he wants. You know, it doesn't matter.
Something less war oriented.
You have no control. You just told me. You can't control that.
I might be able to pick a different video.
Well, if you can give him another video, great. But I mean, you know, that's okay. Don't worry about that. But you talk to him about God. That's the thing. That's the one that's most deep. When his mind is spacing out there, you know, he'll think about these things you discussed. It'll open up the door for him.
He loves Mark Twain. He's a writer. Mark Twain writes about God quite a bit. So I'll do that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Good, Kimberly. Thank you. Very practical.
Thank you, Rabina.
Good, darling. What else, people? Malcolm, look at you, Malcolm Frau, I can't believe it. Hello, sweetheart. We're still alive, aren't we? He's an old friend from about 97 years. Malcolm.
Yeah, I'm still here, just.
You look all right.
It's great to see you. You haven't changed at all.
Oh, come on, I have really, but... Malcolm. Sorry, I'm happy to see you. Happy to see you, so glad.
Lovely to see you.
Yes. So what are the questions, folks? I'll just continue. We've got 15 minutes before we have a break.
Marable?
Yes, good. Jamie.
It's Jamie. Can you explain a little bit more about that, about talking about other religions and how that helps? I can't quite get my head around.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if someone has like a, you know, another belief or doesn't have a belief at all, how that opens the door, as you just said, in terms of.
What I mean is this. What I meant was, in Kimberly's case, her daddy. What I'm trying to mean is what we want to facilitate to occur in the mind of the person who's dying is internal thoughts, thoughts about God, thoughts about heaven, thoughts about virtue and love and compassion. So that's the first point. Can you get that point and why that's logical? Because it's Okay, there's more to it. There's more to it. And Rinpoche talks about this. He talks about this in the chapter on the 12 links of dependent arising. And we'll go into this not now, but I'll discuss it later, but I'll mention it here. This attack, the very clear description in the 12 links of what this is, two separate processes that occur. One is from the sutra teachings, which is the 12 links, and one is the tantric teachings, which is the 8 stages of death. But they're both separate, but they occur simultaneously, obviously, because they're at the time of death, but they're different takes upon it. The sutra microscope and the tantric microscope. So the point is that with the sutra one, with the 12 links, the 12 links is this presentation of the Buddha gave about how we millisecond by millisecond by millisecond, how we create entireties of lifetimes, of our cycles of life. Because of this, therefore this, and then this happens, and that, because of this, and therefore this, and therefore this, and therefore this. And then death comes, and then another life, and then another life. It's perpetual. So that's occurring in daily life all the time. But there's a particular function of these 12 links at the time of death. And Rinpoche discusses that. So the crucial piece, the crucial one, the 8th and the 9th links are called craving and grasping. They're just extra intense levels of attachment. And they kick in every day in the processes that we do. Like, you know, you think about you're missing something. That's dissatisfaction, misattachment. Oh, what's missing? There's the old chocolate cake. Your mind gets all excited. That's craving. And then grasping, the 9th one kicks in, and that makes you stand up and go get the cake. So these extra levels of attachment. So these function, these happen at the time of death. And the function of grasping, this intense one, the 9th one, is that's the one that when it is triggered, when it finally arises about before you stop breathing, that's the one that triggers the karmic seed that will be the one that will determine your next life. So everybody has this grasping. Whether you're a yogi or an ordinary person or a mouse, this intense grasping kicks in. So if you're not practiced, it'll just trigger enormous fear. That's the nature of attachment. It triggers fear naturally. So that's, and if the grasping is intense and you're desperately clinging and holding on to who you are, can't stand to let go, and that's so primordial, this fear, unless you're a practitioner, it's going to be there. And normal people will have it bucket loads when that intense fear comes, holding on to this, then it triggers a seed, and if there's no space for virtue in the mind, it'll be a negative seed and you're programmed to go to the lower realms. So given that most people are not practitioners, and there's Kimberly's dad, let's say, You know, that grasping. So if you, one of the things to talk about is to talk about God. You know, if you're a Buddhist, you talk about your guru, you talk about Buddha, you talk about Pure Land, you talk about these things. So then when your mind is thinking, you're thinking these thoughts about, and then they can make your mind virtuous, and then they can help you, you know, help you die more peacefully. But the particular function of this is this. Rinpoche says this attachment is attachment, is attachment, is suffering, but you can be skillful with attachment. So one of the functions of attachment is to think about the past. One of the functions of attachment is to think about what you haven't got now and cling to things. I want this, I want this, I want this, and grasping. But one of the major functions of attachment is to look forward to something, to anticipate something. We spend our lives driven by, now I'll have lunch, and then I'll do that, and then I'll go to afternoon tea, then I'll have dinner, then tomorrow I'll go this. We never stop, and it's attachment, like a vampire clinging to things to look forward to. Now, as Rinpoche says, you can use this at the time of death. So for Kimberly's daddy, instead of just worrying about who he is and worrying about his bad things and worrying about his guilt and worrying about losing his children, worrying about this and that, whatever we do, so clingy, you start to think about God. Then it opens his mind up. Well, meaning of God. I mean, as Rinpoche says, talk about God too. Talk about how God loves you. Talk about how God is all wise. Talk about how heaven is beautiful. Then if you attach to that, your mind is spacious and you're looking forward to something that can help your mind. And if it's if you get a perfect human rebirth, or you get go to a pure land, because your mind is spacious and peaceful, you're using attachment to look forward to something nice. And you're able, therefore, to let go of this one. And there's not much fear then. Can you hear the point now, Jamie? Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. But what about if someone has no faith or no...
You have to know their mind. So let's say if somebody, but they've got some good qualities. One of the things let's talk about is their good qualities. One of the major things, the thing we never do, because we're always miserable, We never think of our good qualities. So one of the most precious ways you can help a person right there, you know, just is to say you're a wonderful person. You've led a good life, Daddy. You can't believe what a good job you've done. You've done this and you've done this and you've done this and you've helped people. You've been a good husband. You've been a good father. It'll be like joy for his mind to hear this. No, we don't tell ourselves these things, and we mostly don't tell other people. Even if he's been a mean father, and if he does say something, you say, I love you, Daddy. It's all right. I forgive you. It's okay. That'll open his heart and virtue will arise. And that's the point. You want virtue and space to arise in the mind. But talk about kindness. But you've got to know his mind. You've got to know his, let's say your father was an angry person and he hates, you know, doesn't like God or anything. You find a way to help him let go of that, and it's not the real person. You say positive, uplifting things to help his mind be spacious. And when his mind is spacious, virtuous karmic seeds can be triggered. Do you see my point?
I do. Thank you.
Good, good. You've got to know their mind, in other words, you know. And even the person who's a Buddhist. I mean, like Tricia was very independent. My friend, the nun, was very independent. And the nuns who took care of her said she didn't want people mucking around and telling her to do this and that. She organized the things herself. She knew what practices she wanted. And you left her alone most of the time. You've got to know what a person needs. You've got to know what their mind is and what they need, you know. And this is where helping people just with kindness is like a miracle. I think of these people in the old people's home. Then there's no one to talk to, no one to help their mind. Even just the cleaning lady who sweeps the floor next to the bed can be so beneficial to that old person. Tell them they love them, look them in the eye, hold their hand. This is like a miracle. Just to hear positive words is like a miracle, you know, because you know our own minds, we're always thinking miserable things. We're always thinking about our negativity and worry. And here we are dying, completely got no idea what's going on. Don't know where to put our mind, no one there to talk to. It's so stressful. This is why the role of being there is the most precious gift we can give to somebody. Because this is what I think is so powerful and so simple, it's almost embarrassing. You know yourself when you're anxious and worried and things go wrong or you get sick. Look at your mind. The first thing we do is we reach out to somebody. We reach out to somebody. And if you have nobody, then you're just locked. You don't know what to do. You've never trained. You're just locked there. So even the cleaning lady can be the person who you reach out to. And you feel immediately better when she looks at you with love and kindness. It's like a miracle. So then this is the thing. Like, I will never forget. This is so mind-bogglingly simple. It's embarrassing. When you're a little girl, when I was a little girl, and some of us mightn't have mummies, but I had a mummy. And and always fighting and yelling and the whole bunch of kids and, you know, tumbling and crying. And then my mean sister would say something to me and I'd burst into tears. And you check what I did. I made a beeline for mummy. And I look up to mummy's eyes. Mummy, mummy, Janet said I'm cockeyed or something, you know. And you're just looking with complete panic at mummy. And then listen to this. Listen to this. What does mummy do? Oh, darling, it's all right. And she gives you a hug. And guess what? You believe her. That's how you help somebody. Because when you're freaking out, you can't hold your emotions. You don't know what to think. You're panicking. You don't know what to do. You need someone to make you feel that it's okay. That's your role at the time of death, like a miracle. Remember your own experiences and you'll understand, you know. Just to make it, just to be a presence, like a rock of Gibraltar for that person. Don't have to lecture them. You don't have to make it all go away. You can't do that. Don't bring your own junk to the person. Just love them. Be natural and loving and kind and peaceful. And this is, you're like an anchor for them. This is your role. And any other bits and pieces you can do, wow, amazing. It's the most precious gift you can give.
Venerable, we have another question from David.
Yes, David.
Would you like to unmute and ask your question?
Yes, David. Talk to me, darling.
Yes. The Lama Zopa book you've been talking about this afternoon, is it now or will it be available as an audio book?
It's available now, David, both as a paperback and as a book on your iPad or your Kindle. It's available.
But is there going to be an audio book?
Oh, that's a good point. That's the plan, and I'm supposed to be doing it, and I've got to get to the people in Albuquerque and Arroway to organise it. So it's not an audio book yet, but I've talked to Wisdom, and they're prepared to do it. I just finished Mahamudra. That's an audio book now. So I'll be doing, unless he's got someone else, I don't think so. It's quite a big book. It's great, but I think it has to be done. So that's going to, it's going to happen, David. It will be an audio book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good. Okay. Thank you for reminding me. I have to get it going. Go on, people. What else? Other questions?
Any other questions? Elizabeth, would you like to ask your question?
Yes. Hi, Ravina.
Hello, Elizabeth.
Long time no seen.
Yes.
I've got this book, the French version, and correct me if this is...
Comment? What is it? Comment what? How to...
To help your loved ones at the moment of death.
Yeah, that's the one. This is the book. This is the French. It's actually a translation of a slightly older version, but essentially it's the same book. Yes.
Yeah. Because I just wanted to double check with you because it has got the six chapters, and so I got that from the Mayana edition in France.
Exactly, that is the book.
Okay, brilliant.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. What else, people? Something else. Okay, so I'll just continue what we're talking here. We've talked a bit about how to live our lives in the framework of impermanence, which is vital, and death. And then we've talked about that. Now we're talking about the different stages, the weeks and months before. So the first thing is get the room or the environment as conducive as possible for the person to be peaceful. And then according to that person's style, you know, if you've got control over the process, you can, you know, if it's a totally devoted Buddhist and one of your friends, who both of you are students of Lama Zopa, and then you work out her practices, what she likes, what she doesn't like, and you have those available, then the same thing applies. And the things that she sees, should every one of those things should be things that what she wants there. Pictures of Lama Zopa, pictures of His Holiness, a prayer wheel, a stupa, whatever, you know, whatever. You work it out beautifully. Then the many different chapters, what to touch, you know. So for Rinpoche, for example, to have blessing strings, they've been blessed, so you put them on the skin of the person, around their neck or on their body. Mantras especially. Rinpoche's, you know, there's a little box, I don't know if you can still get it, he called it the liberation box, with a half a dozen things in it, like a stupa, a blessing string, a little piece of, you know, a tiny piece of card with mantras written on it, 11 particular mantras that Rinpoche likes, and you put those on the body. You know, like if you're a Catholic, you'd have a scapular, wouldn't you? You know, and we have same things here, look. Protection things. I've got one of these here, you know. Inside there's all these different holy things. And the string itself is blessed. Rinpoche is a real fan of these. He made me wear one. So these are on the body. You can have touching the prayer wheel. You can have texts on their crown every now and again. You can have them, those types of things. And that's, again, up to the person and up to you and what you relate to, what you like. All of these have benefit. Then there's a whole chapter on what to see, the images. Mantras, certain mantras. Rinpoche is famous for finding mantras in the deepest recesses of the most subtle sutras that no one else has heard about. He loves his mantras, you know. So there's one even called Just By Seeing. There's so many mantras. I mean, that one of the chapter in that book that took me the longest was getting the mantras together, because there's so many variations of them, so many variations of the Sanskrit, you know, so many variations of these things, and there's so much confusion about these mantras, so many of them. But they're all marvelous, and you might like one particularly, you might like another. It might be suitable for the person. And this is just then what to hear, what practices to do, what meditations to do. Rinpoche's got a whole bunch of meditations, little ones he's constructed, like on compassion, on Tonglen, on the medicine Buddha, so many of these. You can choose, you know, there's a whole, like I said, a medicine cabinet full of medicines and tools in there. You decide what's beneficial for your animal as well. What to hear, what to touch, what to see, what to talk about. All these different chapters, all according to what's beneficial for your friends, for your loved one's mind. And you have to know their mind and know how to be skillful. Like with Kimberly, with her daddy, you know. Because remember the point of this, and this is the point that's unique to the Buddhist approach. You want everything that you hear, see, taste, touch, smell, especially this and this. I think even especially this one. And I'll describe this later. I'll just say why this one's most powerful, the sound one. Leaves an imprint in the mind of the person. And what you need is those imprints to be as strong as possible at the top of their mind. So when death comes, that'll be the one that prevails in their mind. So if the person who's a communist, and, you know, Jamie's uncle is a communist, and Jamie's talking about the marvelous things he's done in this life to help so many people all over the year, all the workers, you've done so much work, you're so kind, you're so generous. This thought of his own generosity lifts his mind. And that means his mind can be virtuous and spacious. And when his mind is virtuous and spacious, that catalyzes the ripening, the triggering of a virtuous karmic seed in his bank vault, which will program him to get another human life. That's the logic of it, you know. So everything counts. Everything you see, hear, taste, touch, smell counts. But you have to be a bit of a policeman. I remember there was one story about one Buddhist husband who every 2 hours would wake up his poor wife from her exhausted sleep because she's dying and make her do her prayers. And she'd be exhausted, the poor thing. I mean, give her a break, okay? You do the prayers for her. That's too much. That's heavy. Be kind, be gentle, be spacious, you know. So we'll have a break now. Food for thought, okay? 9:38, 9:30, yeah. And I'll be back in an hour, yes, people, darlings, everybody?
Yeah, 5:30. Do you want to do the dedication prayers now, Rabina?
I'll just do them in our thoughts. Just think this hour and a half even. Just as what's happening, this hour and a half, not a single thought has gone astray. We might remember most of them, doesn't matter. These have sown seeds in our mind. We think how marvellous these seeds we've planted.